I'm the type of person, if you ask me a question and I don't know the answer, I'm gonna tell you that I don't know. But I bet you what, I know how to find the answer, and I will find the answer.
All right, the evening cards, it is of course Irish for a very warm welcome, my friends, to Shamrocks and Shanks. Another episode where we get to learn from some of the best professionals in the golf world. Now my guest for this episode is Sean Foley, and Sean is widely recognized as one of the premier golf coaches in world golf, having worked alongside some of the smartest professionals in the golf world, and then using those experiences while helping some of the world's best players to realize their own existing potential. In this episode, we start by chatting about how Sean would best describe what it is that he actually does, and indeed whether the path to get there has been a conscious one, or one more born merely from the ever-changing experiences of life, and indeed the challenges and the failures that it provides us all. We discuss his perspective on how the club golfer can perhaps improve their practice or learning experiences, and leading on from that, we chat about the new learning aid that he has created alongside his fellow Canadian golf coach David Woods. With the mention of that device, the Pro Sender learning aid, we get a chance to delve into some technical discussion on how the device works, and indeed some chats on the role of the trail arm and the wrist in golf swing. We also talk about breathing and its discussion in golf, especially as it refers to the club player. For the coaching section, we discuss his view on protecting players against his preferences in sessions and what might be a more player-beneficial approach. And Sean also gives some advice to coaches out there in creating relationships with experts in certain fields to really improve or hone your craft. Now, when starting to edit this podcast, I felt honestly this was one of my poorer hosting displays. I've known about Sean for nearly 4 years now and gotten to know him better for the last two of those. Some of the most poignant, significant, and career-developing moments of my last 4 years, indeed, have been learnings from Sean, either in person, through messages, or from a post or a podcast, etc. My want for this podcast was to try and give you all a similar experience, and I felt I really didn't ask the right questions to create that learning experience for you all. Aside from that, I think what comes across to me is how comfortable Sean is in actually who he is. He is without doubt one of the smartest people in golf in terms of knowledge and the knowledge to keep learning from others, yet there never seems to exist a need to advertise that fact. I said at the start of this podcast that his influence affected me as a person more than a golf coach, and to be honest, the more I delve into the hierarchy of golf coaching, the more I realize they are equally important to be successful in this field. I spent more than 4 years learning from Sean about love, respect, and being a good human, all the while in the background waiting for that day to learn more about his swing preferences, his thoughts on downswing, etc. But on closer reflection, perhaps my beliefs and what I needed to learn from him was not really aligned with how he felt he could best help. Sean has always insisted you have to go through it to get to it, so I really do hope as you all go through this podcast, you do get something out of it that helps you either as a golfer, a coach, or even as a person. Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Foley.
All right, Sean Foley, very, very warm welcome to Shamrocks and Shanks. Thank you so much for making the time to come on, man. It's I've tried to get you on here for a while. You're so busy, which is a great thing for you, but thank you for making the time this evening. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, my pleasure, man. You know, I support and appreciate and applaud, you know, what you're trying to do within your own career and stuff. So it's all good, man. These aren't things that we have to do. They're just probably things that we should do. You know what I mean? It's all the same. We're all trying to do the same thing, man. Help people play golf better.
Yeah, and you've been like, a very quick side segue, so to speak, you've been very, very supportive with your limited time available. You know, time is so precious that we have with our family, and you with your family, you know, kind of very important, but you've always given me time. So I do really, really appreciate that. And we'll maybe talk a little bit about that later on. You know, normally we get guests on and we kind of lead in with like, okay, you know, your history, your background and stuff, but
I don't really want to do all that.
No, that's why I was about to say, I don't want to do all that stuff, but I would just kind of, I remember hearing you on a podcast. It might have been Jason Sutton's podcast a while back, or it might be someone else's. And you kind of said your envision for your role in a certain time period down the road would be more of a holistic manager of a team of professional athletes, perhaps. So more of an overseer and an all-rounder. Do you think, like in a very, very quick kind of intro, do you think you're there yet? Or how would you kind of describe yourself right now in terms of what you do, what your role is?
I think currently it's probably... I'm a mentor who is a swing expert.
Perfect.
It's not like I don't have more to learn, but I feel pretty confident in what I understand and my experience for, you know, 25 years doing this, basically on a daily basis. All the brilliant people I've been around, all the people who taught me so much. But, you know, nothing's new under the sun, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the golf swing is quite simple. It's just the golfer that's difficult, right? And, you know, communication between two humans and coaching is just so much more than what you understand as it relates to X's and O's, right? Oh, so absolutely. I would say that now, you know, like that's kind of where it is. Like, you know, I spent the weekend out at Half Moon Bay and I was hired to do a golf outing for Chase Banks. And the funny thing is, you know, they hire you because of what you've accomplished. And then all you do is share with their guests all the things you learn from all your failures. And, you know, that's where the real, you know, that's where the real deep wisdom is, I think, is in that. It wasn't malicious. It wasn't on purpose. But obviously what you thought you knew wasn't enough. And so I think that that's, you know, that's very important for people to understand. It's that no matter where people are at, you know, you're not going to walk past a single person today that's not wounded. You're not going to walk past a single person today who doesn't have holdups about themselves. Mm-hmm. I just think when I've been around successful people, and by success, I'm not just talking from a monetary standpoint. I'm talking about, you know, effective people at what they do. Of course, they're probably monetarily doing fine, but that's maybe probably not even their focus. You know, they do two things really well, and then all of their habits almost kind of, you know, are interwoven into those two things, and they got plenty of weaknesses. And but, you know, are you going to spend your whole life fixing yourself when nothing's broken? You know what I mean? There's so many, you know, some people I know have kind of, they're the most confused. They almost have the most self-help books, right? And so, you know, when it comes to teaching golf, you know, do I want to do it the way I did 25 years ago? I don't. I've evolved too much myself. But with all these things that we can help players with, their understanding of meditation and mindfulness and inside out theories and breathing and different physiological things they can do, trying to get their sleep dialed, right? I mean, two of the things we overlook so much are breathing and sleep. And I mean, that's pretty much where life is. Get to where you can't breathe well and get to where you can't sleep well and tell me how you're doing, right?
You're going to struggle. So,
yeah, I mean, the things you can't fast from are breath and water.
Yeah.
So it's all in there. So, you know, and back in the day, it never was really the thing. But, you know, I can get a young player now who spends too much time on Instagram looking at everyone else's swings and reading a bunch of comments. And, you know, that's not Jack Nicklaus and Ben Hogan and guys like that. You know, they saw their instructor once in a while. There wasn't videos. There wasn't TrackMan numbers. Now, I'm not saying that any of that is not good. It's all good. Everything is good. AI is potentially amazing, but it doesn't mean that it's only going to be used for potentially amazing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
right. So
yeah,
I think it's sometime.
Sorry.
Go ahead. What were you saying?
As Mark Bull always says to me when we're having conversations, it's like the information is great, but it's what the person does with it is the most important thing.
Yeah, Bully. I love listening to him. I can listen to him all day. Yeah, of course, right? It's like that even him with his, I don't know if anyone has, well, there's probably a few guys who have all done it to the same extent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, looked at and understood the inner workings of the golf swing more than a guy like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you still have to be able to sell yourself to that person in front of you who's probably not good because they're not really open to doing things differently. I would say humanity is definitely stuck in its comfort zone. And so to progress, you know, you got to go through it.
Yeah.
Right. So most things you have to really do the small things well, and you have to work at them almost being passionate about the mundane until much more down the road do you really see the fruit of your labors. And society's definitely not going that way based on the fact that, you know, I can almost order anything to my house within 1 hour or within one day. Right. So everything is going to be more impatient. Everything is going to be more entitled. Everything is going to be more demanding. You know, I speak to my buddies who are, you know, work at companies, and they might be vice presidents or presidents, and they get two or third year people coming in going, you know, I can't believe I haven't made it to executive manager yet. And it took these guys like 20 years to get there.
Yeah.
And so as that relates to golf, that's probably not a winning solution, right? Like
the impatience of wanting to progress in such a short period of time.
Yeah. It's probably not going to do very well for you. Right.
Yeah. For many of us, like, we see people through the perspective of the environment or the role that we meet them in. Okay. So we kind of like meet a doctor, we kind of view them through that perspective at first. And so it makes sense that when I kind of first came across you, so to speak, not having met you yet, I would have looked at you through that perspective of your influence on me in terms of golf coaching, golf knowledge, golf technical ability, all those things. But I think your influence on me, when I look back at it in the last 3 or 4 years from a distance first, and then a little bit more personal in the last couple of years, has been emphatically more on me as a human being. Are you conscious of that goal to, and maybe it isn't a goal, to be seen as much more than a golf coach? Or is it just a result of how you feel you can best help people that you interact with?
No, I don't really care how I'm perceived. I don't do anything for anybody else. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, I was born in 1974, and you know, on my headstone, it's going to be 1974 dash. And then who knows what the end date will be. It's like, what do you want to do with your dash? You got to remember, man, you're probably not going to be remembered except by very few people, and things go and they move on. And so 95% of what you're stressed out about is useless. And it's just taking away from the abundance of your experience. And by saying that, we want to experience life, but you can't avoid life to experience life. So you got to go through the ups and downs. You wouldn't know what joy felt like if you didn't know what pain felt like. And so it's kind of all just teachable moments, but I mean, it's not overly that important. So what are you going to do with your dash? Right. And mm-hmm. when it comes down to being who you are, you know, you have to be who you are because everyone else is taken. And so for me, you know, I've always wanted to just be cool with myself and become to where I'm at peace within my own mind. And I think that that's really, you know, that's what I'm after. And that's a place that, you know, I inhabit a lot of the time. And so when I didn't inhabit this place, then I needed things from outside of me to make me feel certain ways. But, you know, as time goes on, you realize that, you know, there's a flow to your career. There's a flow to your relationships. You know, there's a flow to everything, and there's going to be upticks in the flow and downticks in the flow. And I think that, you know, if you have meaning and purpose and like a deep meta perspective, whether you're up or down, it doesn't really matter. And a lot of the up and down, you don't really have any control of. So kind of being at peace with the experience, I think, is the most important part. Trying to not label things as good or bad or Christian or Muslim or just labels, just things that really get us to tap into biases at a deep level that kind of give us not much of an ability to see things for what they may be. You know, a lot of people just see life through their belief systems. They see something and they're like, well, I believe that to be this. Well, if that's what you believe that to be, that's what you're going to see. So yeah, it's kind of, and I don't know, maybe some of this came along from being a coach for a long time. Mm-hmm. But probably more than anything, just being a father. And, you know, not want to be the guy who says something and then your kids can look at you and see you don't actually do what you say. Maybe, you know, between my wife and my sons, you know, I know a couple people, if you ask them how they're doing, they'll say, well, my wife and my kids are healthy, so I'm fine. And they actually mean that. That doesn't mean if they're on an uptick or a downtick, the fact that their loved ones are healthy and not happy so much. Happiness kind of comes and goes, right? It's nothing you can kind of get on purpose. It can feel like that, but that's just a placebo. So when I'm happy, the things outside of me are the same as when I'm unhappy. So I'm not really after being happy. I know that will come. Just like you're in the middle of 3 days of bad weather, you know, at some point it's going to be sunny and beautiful again. That's just how it works, right? You can't, and just because it is, you know, raining and there's lightning and thunder, it doesn't mean it's not blue above. So I think just kind of knowing that it's okay that you're not happy. I think there's a lot of people out there think something's wrong with them because they're not happy all the time. And that's because I think we've been taught, you know, you need to be happy. Mm-hmm. I think if you're healthy, the chances of you being happy are probably higher. I think if you sleep well, the chances of you being happy are higher. I think if you eat well, and I don't mean to say that in a cavalier way, because a lot of eating well isn't cheap and people have to eat what they can eat. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean that by any means. Right. If you think about it, love, exercise, sunlight, breathing, and going in the water, those are five things that are super important to human beings, and they're all free. You know, they're all free. It's cracked me up in the last few years is, you know, titans, icons and titans of businesses, and they're all giving us their cheat list. And it's like meditation, mindfulness, and cold plunging. And it's like, that's what we've been doing for 400,000 years. You and I would wake up at first sunlight, right? We'd be up, we'd be out with the sun first thing in the morning. So everything guys like Andrew Huberman talk about, we're now able to measure that. But of course, for 99% of being a man, that was the case. We were up and we went and we were in contact with the earth. So we were grounding with this massive magnetic force. And then we went and we hunted. And when we failed during the hunt, we'd release dopamine so we wouldn't quit. And we'd go out and we'd hunt. And, we'd either kill or we wouldn't kill. And, you know, where along the lines did it come that you need to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Right? Like, where is that? And so I think as it relates to North America, the Western world, if you always chase where the money goes, you can always realize where the agenda is generated. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sitting there thinking like, why am I not happier? But look, if I'm waking up three times during the night, I'm not hydrated, I'm not helping myself. So, you know, I think there's a lot of physiological things that human beings can do that will really change their psychology.
So when you're talking about this stuff and this material that you've kind of talked about for the last 5 minutes, and are you conscious that that's a skill, that that's an attractive proposition or attractive knowledge base for a golfer or a professional golfer to come and talk to you, or even attractive for me to hear? So, you know, you would have like, and this is kind of my original question is like, okay, I'm a golf coach, but you're more than a golf coach, because like, you know, and maybe it's perspective that a golf coach is just, I'm going to go along, they're going to tell me technically what I want. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think some of the players that come to you for your help would be looking for more than that, you know, are looking for exactly what you kind of just presented there, where you have more holistic approach, more personable approach, and deal more with the human. And my point is that a skill that you felt you developed, or something that has just happened to you as you've gone through life?
Yeah, like I said, I just wanted, you know, I just want to feel better. I just want to, you know, I've been my own experiment, right? So it's
got to go through to get to it, kind of thing.
Right. I mean, I've told many of my players to go see a therapist. You know why? Because I've worked with therapists before. I've worked with one as early as 3 years ago, every second Monday at 8 a.m. He was in Sweden. And we just worked and we just talked, and I listened to what he had to say, listened to what I had to say. He taught me a few things that were really dope. And people were saying to me like, Sean, you of all people, why would you see a therapist? And I was like, well, I know how to work out, but I have a trainer. Like, I know how to work out. I just find that when I work out with a trainer, I kind of do the shit that I don't want to do, right? Like, if it's me in there by myself, it's probably my hip hop playlist. There's some pull-ups in there. There's some push-ups, probably sitting on the bench, you know, re-texting somebody. When I'm with my trainer, I looked at the clock five times this morning, like, holy shit, I got 30 minutes left with this guy. I'm going to die, right? So, but I know a lot about working out. I could give you a great workout. In many different disciplines, right? I got a lot of smart friends that I've spent a lot of time with and watched what they did. So I just overall just interest, you know, just interest and curiosity. But, you know, is is Coach K really a basketball coach? If you ask Grant Hill, not really. He was like a mentor, and you know, he was another man. You know, he's got a dad that he respected and admired, but he had another man to kind of, you know, help him out. So when you get a 24-year-old kid that you start working with, you know, you're going to have to let them make their own mistakes so they can learn from it. But there's some that you can sit there to help them avoid and kind of get ahead of it. But I mean, you know, a lot of the data shows that you get a 28-year-old tour player that comes to you, they're pretty cemented in how they move and what they do. So the reason swing changes don't work is because they don't work. Like neurologically, it just doesn't happen. So can you help somebody? Like if someone thought they hooked it for the opposite reason they hooked it, by getting them to explain that and they get it, they're going to be way better after that. Yeah. So there's the conceptual aspect that's super, super important. You know, like I would never have known when I first started teaching on tour that the par three has it. If the first numeral is a two and then your second shot into a par four, the first numeral is a two, the only business you have is hitting it into the middle of the green.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you might want to learn how to hit a high hold fade into a right pin, but I mean, at a certain distance, that's just potentially like a really bad idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of a combo of, you know, swing stuff.
Yeah.
Data. A few things like that. My buddy Craig Davies is calling me on the other line. But even that's the thing, you know, Craig is Craig, right?
Yeah. Really smart guy. So
Craig is, I think, one of the finest sports chiropractors in the world. Mm-hmm. And I've been noticing with Ben on lately, like in the backswing, he's been kind of, his forearms have been rolling. And then from in front, I see his head's not moving mostly how it does. It's kind of looks a little bit more here. And then it gets almost gets a bit into extension in the backswing. Mm-hmm. And so Ben's neck is tight. So I've seen some of the shot tracker and then called him earlier. And so him and I have been working together for 17 years and we still do this on a daily level. Just keep communicating, stay organized with what we're doing. Like if he says, hey, it's going to take me a couple days to get his neck good, then maybe he's going to have to, you know, feel like he gets the face more closed in the backswing, or maybe we're going to focus more on the follow through. You see what I'm saying?
It's yeah.
Like we're going to have to put duct tape on it like 50% of the time.
Yeah. You just have to be malleable in terms of, as you all talk about, don't let your preferences get in the way of what the player actually needs.
Yeah. And I feel like is, you know, I think I read that when I was younger and it really hit me. And I think, you know, I'm kind of getting to where there almost isn't a preference because I think it's quite obvious what's happening. I mean, if you look at what Sasho says and you look at what Mark Bull says, it's probably not much further from there. Right.
Yeah.
So super smart dudes that I totally appreciate their friendship and their guidance. But in many cases for me, they just answered what I had seen for so long. I just couldn't really put my finger on it. And if I'd known it then, I probably wouldn't have had as much self-discovery, which led to some great things. But as well, probably would have had a player stick with something longer than I did because I didn't always know why it worked. It doesn't mean I can make it work. I'm not the one swinging the golf club, right? Like
yeah.
I charge my players 5%. So yeah. That's the deal, right?
Yeah, I think it's so, like, I know when I spent time with George out in LA a couple of weeks ago, it was definitely, I'd seen things happen in the current swings that I felt didn't look right. But again, I couldn't explain them. And then George would see the same things and explain it in this very, very kind of visual and as George does. And then suddenly it would click in my head. But again, you know, I could have read that in the book, but not understand that as well as you having to like really be there, experience it and kind of fail a little bit to learn as you go. In previous podcasts, you've been known to kind of like self-questioning regarding how you navigate and perhaps conduct a coaching session and what constitutes success in that sphere. In a way to kind of help club golfers, because we kind of have a little section here where we help club golfers in their own kind of like delving into the search for improvement, What do you think, like, should or could a good learning session look like for a club player? They get out on the driving range, or even on the practice area, whatever phrase you would like. What might that look like in terms of a success, or kind of definitely priming themselves or creating a template for success, let's say?
I don't know if I have that answer, just because if I did, I'd probably have a private jet. You know what I mean?
Fair enough.
We
could try.
You could say get pro sender. I could have flown up there and done this with you. Or I could have picked you up. We could have done it on my plane, right? On the way.
Perfect.
To we go to Paris and party tonight.
Yeah.
I think it depends, like, what they're there for, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
we got to remember, when people finish playing golf, people ask them what they shot. So I think if someone's really interested in their improvement and want to work with a CPGA or a PGA of America coach, it should be that way. Because I mean, I did, it was a couple of years ago, I forget, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I had this girl come to me for a lesson. She was like 13 and she was impressive, man. She was like really impressive. She was hitting balls, and I worked with her. I didn't say a whole lot to her, but I showed her how to kind of curve the ball more by using ball position, and she enjoyed that. And then with 5 minutes left in the lesson, she goes, I was here to ask you if you could take a look at my chipping. And I'm like, dude, what are you, like, I didn't even ask her.
Yeah.
I didn't even ask her, right? I mean, how stuck am I into, ooh, I'm a swing coach. Like, what a dumbass, right? So
yeah.
Anyways, I ended up not charging her, and then not charging her for the lesson I gave her the next day, because I wanted to pay penance for my stupidity. So, like, people want to shoot better scores, right? I mean, how many people have you coached in the last month that if they came within the time they have, because obviously these are not tour players,
mm-hmm.
like, okay, I'm this far from the fairway.
Yeah.
And I have two sons in lacrosse, and you know what I do every weekend? I go to lacrosse.
Yeah.
So I live this close to the fairway and go to a golf course every day, and I don't have time to get better. So I know that people are dealing with that. So say I said I really want to get better. It's not something that I really care about, but say if I said, you know, I want to get better, right?
Yeah.
So when I give myself probably 2 hours a day, I can manage that.
Mm-hmm.
2 hours a day. So how many of the people you coached in the last month, if all they did was bring their wedges and their putter, would they start shooting lower scores in 2 months?
Probably all of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So the PGA Tour levels where the short game doesn't really stand out as being overly important, right?
Yeah.
They're all pretty good.
Yeah.
And then there's some that are insane. But every single week, man, those ball strikers are up there, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, that's where you, unless you're so crazy, crazy unicorn good at one skill, it just seems that, and I think it's actually quite data driven of why it is that way, but it does seem that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Scotty Scheffler has almost lost strokes per round for the last, what's he not finished outside the top 13 for 7 events, right?
That's crazy. Yeah.
That's some, like, he keeps doing that. That's some Ben Hogan of his generation business, right?
Yeah. I saw, going back to Bully, I saw him, his interview with Graham Walker. And Graham was talking about this little task that he used to do, where he used to get players, he'd put an alignment stick about 6 yards in front of them, and they'd have 5 golf balls, and they had to hit the alignment stick before they could kick off the lesson. So I started doing it when all my lessons there start in the chipping area. They go from 5 yards, 10 yards, 15 yards. And all they have to do is hit the green, but like kind of going into that kind of same area. Some of the actions I've seen from the chipping actions that I wouldn't have seen before if we were just doing range work have been questionable. So it's a good insight. Yeah.
Bro, it almost, Graham's awesome, by the way. It doesn't get better. He's great.
Yeah.
Look, I think the difference with like a full swing is if everything's out of position, you still have time. But with short game, man, when that club gets out of position, you're pretty much dead because there's no time, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's really imperative and important at that level to see, because, you know, I do lots of pro-ams, obviously, and I have done for many years. And, you know, everyone wants to talk about the slice they have, but they actually slice it pretty consistent, like very consistent. But then they get in a greenside bunker and it's, you know, takes like five shots from there. Then say you wanted to improve a skill, you know, obviously you're going to, you know, people, when I need to know things like this, I call people like Will Wu, right?
Yeah, is, Will's fantastic.
It depends where they're at in their development.
Yeah.
And then depends what it is that they want to do. Like, I mean, we can all sit there and use 3D and say, God, you should be turning more, but we don't know what their feet do. We don't know what their tibias do. We don't know what their pelvis does. We don't know how much thoracic rotation we have. So, yeah, it's obvious to go, hey, look, here's an average tour player. Here's you. But I think most everything has to relate to people being able to hit the ball and find the ball. So,
yeah,
I think being able to add upgrades to people's geometry in their golf swing is much more important, I think. But that being said, you know, I've had some buddies that I've played in member events with, and I caddy for them, and they're obviously 15 handicaps and they have no chance in a fairway bunker. So we never even come within 20 yards of one off a tee.
Yeah.
There's so many ways to skin the cat, right?
So it's going away from what would be the traditional, well, how do I, you know, practice my swing better, or how do I learn better to, well, actually, you know what, if you took the wedge and the putter, create some nice skill games for yourself, some nice challenges maybe, and then talk a little bit about course management, like, you know, maybe some decade stuff or something like that. Those kind of three areas would be nice ways to improve straight away. And then you can kind of get into the finite of the golf swing and a bit more of that stuff if you really wanted to.
Yeah, like if I could create the conglomerate, say I had like the super sweet place and I just had the conglomerate.
Yeah.
You know, I would want, you know, people like Brody or Fawcett, Mark Bull, Craig Davies, Sasha McKenzie. I let them do what they do. I'll do what I do, right? It's like I have the ability to take all that information and then understand that, okay, where's the low-hanging fruit as it relates to this person improving? Mm-hmm. I think that's always the key, right? I mean, how many times have I've said this so many times, but it still continues to happen. And I've been guilty of this myself, is, you know, someone will notice that I'm really tan at an airport or something.
Yeah.
And say, what do you do for a living? And I say, I teach golf. And they go, oh, I took lessons and ruined my game.
Like, they weren't off me. Unless you're in Glen Abbey in like 1995 circa.
Yeah, well, that's giving over $30,000 in refunds, which I did.
Yeah.
That's not a good business. My boss was not thrilled with that.
I'm sure he wasn't. I remember you telling me that story. Moving on from that, or kind of tying nicely into that, this is something you mentioned earlier on. It's something I've been kind of involved with in Europe Pro for the last couple of years, is terms of breathing. And you talked about that earlier on, how important it is, right? So let's not, like, I don't want to sound condescending when I say how important this is. Can we, or is there a way to get more golfers doing that? So training or practicing that, how we breathe. And that would definitely, like, you know, we don't have to get into the central nervous system and fight or flight, but we know that that would really help performance. But how do we, and I'm going to say sell them on it, but because I don't have another phrase at the moment, sorry, but how do we sell them on it that this is a legitimate way of improving your golf game, is to actually train how you breathe more properly?
Look, all you can do, I was on the phone before I got on with you, with one of the agents who works with one of my players.
Mm-hmm.
And all you can do is tell them what you think they should do.
Yeah.
Provide them with the details of how to do that and hope they do it.
Okay.
So it ain't really about selling. I mean, if you know, if you have to sell to someone that breathing properly is a super important skill,
we're in trouble.
then we're in trouble. I mean, just think about someone in the dead fits of an anxiety attack. They can't what? they can't breathe.
Yeah.
So breathing is very, very important, and it's really hard to sit and breathe and then think about other things. So all breathing does is bring us back to where we always are, which is the present. It's just our mind that takes us out of, like, being present isn't something you need to learn to do. It's where you exist. Mm-hmm. It's just the mind going out and about. And look, our brain has been designed to help us survive, not necessarily thrive. So people keep doing the same things that they've always done, and they get the same results. But if you have kind of empathy from a neuroscience standpoint, you understand that the brain doesn't really like cognitive. It likes cognitive ease. It's not big into cognitive strain. I mean, just look at society, bud. Like it's we're not evolving, we're de-evolving. And so, you know, I just think if you simply look at what we would have done up to 500 years ago, right? I mean, all these people who in the world who are inflamed, and then we get in the hot shower, and it's like it doesn't benefit us or help us, but it doesn't mean that hot showers don't help certain things. So there's just so much low-hanging fruit, I think, like things that don't take you to change at all, but just start to implement them, you know, implement them on a daily basis, and then expect, you know, it's human beings are incredible. Remember, the guy who's 600 pounds still has a six pack. You just can't see it.
Yeah.
You know,
the potential is there.
Of course. But, yeah, you know, people have to make, you know, decisions. You know, Apple did that commercial years ago, and it had, you know, Dr. King and Einstein and all those different people. And the selling phrase in the commercial was the weird ones. Right. These are people who were more celebrated after they were dead than when they were alive. So it could be very rare that people are willing to go, you know, above and beyond the domestication and indoctrination of our education and of our thought. You know, like the things that I hear sometimes down here in the States, it just blows me away. But I also know that there's a large part of our brain that's designated to being part of a tribe. That helps that survival mode. Back 300,000 years ago, if you and I were kicked out of the tribe in the middle of winter, we're probably not going to make it.
Mm.
So it's okay to be worried about it's okay to be concerned with how people see you. But I think over time, as the brains evolve, it's also given a capacity to challenge why that needs to be the case, right? So when people say, I don't care what people think about me, it's like, you may think you don't, but there's a part of your brain that is, it's very necessary that you are thought about.
Do you think, are there many players on tour that are training breathing at the moment? Do you think it's like something that's very, very existing on tour right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And you know, the way they're doing it, they're kind of all on the, they're all on the quiet about it, but yeah, that's going on 100%. I mean, look, if it's good enough for a special forces sniper, then it's good enough for me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That'll do.
And I think part of the reason it's important too is because the big difference between obviously being at war and in a battle, but based on people's perspective, there's a lot of golfers out there where when they're out there, you know, their adrenal systems think it's life or death, right? It's like their identity is connected to what they shoot. When they play well, their wife knows it when they walk in. When they play bad, their wife knows it when they walk in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how do you make it matter more and then matter less? And I think that's kind of that's the trick.
Yeah. I've always kind of like, again, like looking at you as kind of like a model to what I want to do, or kind of taking information from you. I've always found it, when I've kind of looked back through the years, elusive to pin down your exact thoughts or even preferences on the golf swing. And you say you don't have any, which is absolutely fine.
Well, no, but, I mean, of course I do. But I would just say that they're not really preferences. They're more just like science.
Okay. Beliefs. Would that work? No.
I don't really think like Sasha's and Mark's stuff's their beliefs. There's measured data.
Okay.
Trackman's not a belief.
Yeah.
Like a belief is like protein being good to help convert to amino acids to build muscle is not a belief. Santa Claus is a belief. Yeah. Having a one plane swing is a belief.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
right.
But we digress. We'll continue on with the question. I'm getting somewhere with this. Well, with the release of the incredibly popular Pro Sender, congratulations to you and Mr. David Woods on that. And I call it a learning aid. It's kind of given us a small glimpse, perhaps, into some of your own hierarchy in the golf swing. So talking about wrist structures, let's say. Can you chat a little bit about the Pro Sender learning device? And I use the term learning device really deliberately because I think the good thing about this is the intention in the creation of this device seems to be not only to encourage certain movements, but to also do so in a very specific method of learning. So a deliberate requirement of attracting one correct movement as opposed to roadblocking an incorrect one, that which we've seen before. So more of a constraints. Can you kind of talk a little bit about the device and kind of just mention it somewhat and kind of the theory and the kind of practicality behind it?
Well, with the Pro Sender, and this was the Pro Sender, the wrist guard was designed by David, mm-hmm. and he kind of designed it to help him with what he was struggling with. And so, you know, when I take my grip, you can still see there's quite a bit of space in there.
Yeah, between the back of the device, yeah.
Right? And mm-hmm. so in the backswing, it'd be very rare to see a good player with their wrist like that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. More normal to see that.
A little bit more and extension, yeah.
Definitely, right? Pronation, extension.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we see with the amateurs is, you know, right wrist extension is, say, 20 to 32. And yeah. pros are 43 to 62, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Something like that. I would mm-hmm. ask Jeff Smith. If I needed to know that, I'd ask Jeff Smith.
Okay.
So, but it's you can say the net mid is about 51.
Okay.
Now, if I'm a baseball pitcher, it's going to be similar.
Okay.
If I'm throwing a javelin, it's going to be similar.
Okay.
If I'm throwing a football, it's going to be similar.
So you're seeing different, similar measurements in terms of how much that trail wrist went into extension from across those sports.
Yeah, I think if you put this on a world-class quarterback, I don't think it would – I think they'd go like, well, that's what I do.
Yeah, it wouldn't feel any massive difference to them. Yeah, okay.
So based on the body moving through a stretch phase, a counter-rotation phase, an extension phase, which is pretty much as old as human movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then us seeing, you know, we grew up and they taught us about plane and trying to be up and down on the same plane. But since the advent of, you know, cameras that can paint the screen, we see that's just really not the case.
Yeah.
And very rarely do you see anyone, you know, come down more over here than they went back this way. Yeah. So when you look at amateurs, they have more right elbow bend than pros, and they have more, the wrist is closer to flexion with yeah. their right hand.
Yeah.
So that just doesn't look like a good place to hit a golf ball from. Because when True. We watch the pros at Impact, you know, their arms are fairly extended. There's yeah. sure there's a couple who are.
Yeah.
But I think if we look through the ages of players, they're more here.
Yeah, they're definitely going more into the extension with that trail arm, True Impact, for the majority.
So if my right arm is this bent, I'm going to have almost no time to get it to extend.
Yeah.
So what happens is when the wrist gets into extension here, and then the way it's been designed, you can't really get into where you overhinge it at all.
Okay. Yeah, I get you.
So the overhinging is the reason that the arm gets so narrow. I've never seen anyone overhinge it and be like this, really. That's just, you will never do that, bud.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you were completely trying to miss the ground altogether. So you might see this in the clinic because someone doesn't want to hurt themselves.
I've seen some, yeah.
Because they won't hit the ground from here. You can yeah. guarantee that.
Yeah.
So basically just allows the mass of the club to stay behind the hand path.
Mm-hmm.
And as the right arm extends, the shoulder stays external longer before it goes internal. And I think that, you know, when we can line up the mass of the club behind the hand path for most golfers, they're going to get a lot better. And then we do know from 3D that even Adam Scott at the top, his face is almost 100 degrees open on gears.
Yeah.
So we're just putting them in a better place that they can rapidly close the face.
Yeah.
And, you know, one word that I don't like in golf instruction that you hear all the time is, you know, stable club face. Like, what is that even? That's not even close to stable. Like, there's nothing about it that – imagine how slow you'd have to go to have a stable club face. I mean, I don't even think Tiger's putting stroke had a stable club face. I think it was quite, you know – I don't know much about putting, by the way. And then – you know, we put the ball in closer, you know, when Sasho talks about the net force vector between the hands,
mm-hmm.
the left hand and the right hand and the pulling and pushing along with a couple forces.
Mm-hmm.
Closer you get the ball to the wrist, the better you're going to do those things. So once again, that's, I could probably hit a short-sided bunker shot from there, but that's, if I need to hit it fat and only hit it 10 yards, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But that puts me into a position that, you know, if people have enough thoracic rotation, enough shoulder mobility,
yeah,
then they can do that. It doesn't mean that I'm against anyone being like this in the top of their backswing to get time and space.
Yeah.
But it would be a good idea in transition to try and get it back on.
Yeah, that's a nice way of looking at it.
And it's just there. Yeah, look, if I see a guy and it's like he needs to hit the ball further to play better, I'm not gonna get him, you know, hear more. If he wants to hit it straighter, totally. If he wants to hit it further, we might have to play around up here a bit. But it just, you know, remember, your instruction needs to be in such a way that you have the number one, you make the best genes in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who comes to you, you're going to have to tailor their fit differently. But it's still denim, Steve. So when people say, well, you know, style versus dynamics, the style is that both you and I, you like chocolate chip cookies and I like brownies. But the dynamic is we both are after the sugar.
Yeah.
So where's the denim in the golf swing? Where's the sugar in the golf swing? And then the rest is just style.
Yeah.
So yes. I've yet to see anybody really with the face wide open with the center of mass directly on top of the hands at like six ever hit a great shot.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we just need to stop confusing it. I feel like I could go on the street and teach everyone how to shift their weight and turn their body, but I can't teach everyone to hit it out of the middle of that club face because that's where it matters. And I think if you think about it too, right? Like really simply, if we're here at impact, okay, so what's the tour averages of left wrist flexion and impact? You know, 7?
Yeah, about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then why not precede impact?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because what Sasho says, which, and I know I always say what Sasho says, but I think he's more right than I am,
yeah,
is once the hands get, you know, to the rib cage or upper hip, it's all she wrote for angular changes with your hands.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I mean, really, I think you can argue golf's pretty much a backswing game.
Yeah, I've always said that to me, just two windows of really proposing change, and that would be pre, where you can kind of talk about perception, understanding kind of what you think's going to happen, and then backswing is the kind of second window, and there isn't a third one. Once you, as Sasha would say, once you kick down there and hands go near rib cage, it's... you're reacting at that stage. You can't really, it's very difficult to consciously make change.
Yeah. I just started working with Eric Van Rooyen.
Yeah.
Nice guy. Good, beautiful swing. Hits the ball nice. But I just feel like because of his grip, his club face is not going to change his grip. His club face is too open. And then he doesn't turn a lot. But he can move through his shoulder, so you know he just ends up a bit too much like this.
Mm-hmm.
So get his elbows closer together, get him to allow his pelvis to turn freely, I mean, I think if we do that for 6 months, we're going to hit it better, Steve.
Yeah, 100%. Was there any specific kind of thoughts and something that's kind of always molded in my mind the last while? Any specific thoughts towards that trail hand being more dominant than lead? Like, obviously, that trail arm and the trail wrist going through a lot more motion, a lot more change than that lead arm. Was that the kind of theory behind it? No,
I just think that a lot of right-handed golfers are right-handed people. And when you start talking about bowing, they don't get it. And they might bow it, but get it way open too. Like, so it's not, and in bow it, they might get the center of mass way too laid off.
Yeah.
So what, like, where I have two tricky ones, Ben On and Michael Kim are both left-handed people who are right-handed golfers.
Oh, interesting. Didn't know that. Yeah.
And so from the top, they do a lot of pulling.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, that there's pulling. So they have to always feel like all their feels are creating width and getting everything away from them.
Okay.
And in doing so, they create a slightly better moment of counter rotation. The club ends up just slightly more behind them, and then they're able to turn through the ball more than their whole follow through going into side bend to try and keep it from getting across them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's one, it's healthier, obviously. You don't want to be going into more side bend in the breaking phases.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, hopefully we can just hang out there for 2 years and see how it goes. But, you know, we're up on it. We're in a better place than we were last year. I mm-hmm. would imagine next year at this time we'll be in a better place than we are now. But, you know, you just got to stay on it, man. You just got to stay on it. And you never know when someone shoots 62 on a Friday out of nowhere, hit it in the trees on Sunday, it kicks out in the middle of fairway, and they hit a three with a 10-foot make eagle. I mean, how many times have I seen these things occur? So you just got to keep them – you almost got to keep them safe from themselves, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, yeah, no, it's just really interesting in terms of that right-handed, left-handed divide and trail hand, lead hand, and that influence. It was always my issue with that lead wrist flexion was – the pressure you're putting on that trail lunate bones and in that trail hand, how much you're actually like pushing back when there's this mass flexion of that lead wrist. So if you're kind of like,
I think if I'm here and then I apply rotation to my right wrist,
mm-hmm.
that just bows it.
Yeah.
Rather than I can bow it and actually not do that with my right wrist.
Yeah.
So here I am there. Here I am there. It's way different. It's so different.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you know, if we've got more of this in the past because we were turning the right side more than the left side. I just look, most right-handed people don't do much left-handed, mate. So it's probably got to have a higher neural connection to time and space, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. If we can kind of just, again, I know you're very tight for time, so I won't keep you much longer. If we had just a couple of questions for the coaches that listen, one of the things that's always been fascinated listening to you from my perspective is, and you might correct me in even this question, but you often refer to this fight against your preferences and protecting your players against them. How do you distinguish between your like intuitive reaction or that tacit knowledge base and those preferences? So, and is there room for instincts as a coaching trait becoming less required or even usable with the ever-present ability to measure everything?
I mean, the thing is, if you start to read the neuroscience stuff, you know that basically whatever you measure is going to stay pretty much the same.
Okay.
Right? Like, so I don't have guys who are consistently one left with their path, and next thing I know, they're four to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're so automated, right? Like, we're so automated. So, yeah. look, everything is great. Like, a little pepper is great. Too much pepper is not good, right? A little bit of water is not enough. And too much water is not good either. So, it's where it fits. And so, sometimes I'll get a player who I don't think they understand enough about some of that stuff. Yeah. And I think that there would be better at problem solving themselves if they understood some of that stuff. Sometimes you got a player who they weren't golfing. They'd probably be an engineer, and they need to understand that to create pictures.
True.
That's more rare, I'd say, from pro golfers. Yeah, I just think it ultimately comes down to what does that person need to do. So I spend, you know, a lot of time, but me kind of just going over my players and where they're at, it kind of is a never ending loop.
Yeah.
So by the time I'm going to say something to them, it's definitely not going to be instinctive or intuitive. I think that's quite easy with a 20 handicap, but we got somebody else who, you know, in front of you is a great guy on the course, is a nut job. You know, I think the most important thing you can teach that guy is, like, none of those guys understand the pure chemical and physiological shock of anger and what it emits as it relates to adrenaline and cortisol. And I find that as soon as they read that, they're not as angry anymore, because it's like, yo, this getting like this really costs you a lot of money and a lot of world ranking points. And so, you know, we can go and see a therapist and figure it out. But I mean, if you just actually understand how bad anger is for you, I mean, anger is technically almost worse than smoking. So if you don't smoke because it's not healthy, then why would you get angry when it's exactly as bad? But they never heard that before.
Yeah.
So they might even been told, like, yeah, the greats get pissed off and succeed. And it's like, no, they don't. No, they don't.
Yeah.
They did not do that. Okay. Just because Tiger slammed clubs did not mean he was angry at all.
Yeah.
At all. Right. Because if he was, there's no way that he would have been able to go and do what he did. There's nothing wrong with having momentary outbursts of emotion and get it out, good or bad, and move on. So I know a lot of players who look, you know, people, I like his attitude on the course. They don't know what that guy's saying to himself inside his head.
Yeah.
So I don't really think it's about positive self-talk. I've never been proven that has convinced me to do that. But I've been convinced that negative self-talk is not a good. How about understanding your process, where you're at, your purpose, the difficulty of the game, and the variability of human learning? So if you understand that, you're probably not going to be as hard on yourself when you realize that, you know, this is difficult. This is very, and that's what people love about it, is the pure challenge of it.
Yeah, you're never actually going to get it right. So perhaps when you're talking about those preferences, it's more focusing on what the player is bringing to the table and how you can help them, as opposed to what you feel you should teach them, what they can kind of learn. Knowing what you know now, I imagine there's been certain subjects you've studied and learned that perhaps had more impact in helping you get to the point in your life and career. So hypothetically speaking, if we opened a Sean Foley School for Aspiring Coaches tomorrow in Toronto, what would be high on the syllabus in terms of learning? So, you know, coaches, like, and I hate the way people go, oh, young coaches. I'm like, I don't care what age you are. If you really wanted to help a coach learn in terms of what you've experienced.
How about you can only come if you're open-minded? That could be young or old. So, I don't know. I think where I've been very fortunate is, you know, most of my close friends on tour are osteos and chiros and physios. I think if you really understood the body, you'd spend less time teaching it, because you'll know that, yeah, you can see what that person needs to do, but like, they can't even use their big toe properly. So there's no way they're going to create a vertical force to help turn their pelvis. Like, so I think that's really helped me to be less harmful, is like, someone's not going to come to me and I'm going to show them how to use their legs. There's plenty of excellent trainers out there who that's kind of their, you know, that's their world. Mm-hmm. I think staying in your own lane is important. Once again, like, those very successful people, kind of two strengths. They weren't, you know, guys will send me DMs or leave me an email, and they've got like 19 certifications that are all 2 days. And it's like, well, like, it's not impressive to me that you have that many certifications. It's impressive to me that you're curious and that you're investing in your learning. But I mean, those are 2 day seminars.
Yeah.
Like, what can you learn in 2 days?
Yeah, very little.
Yeah, you can, you know what, you can get a syllabus to go and really learn over 2 years.
Give me a nice intro into it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm not saying there's no value to it. I'm just saying it's like, that doesn't mean to me you know a lot. Like, if I know 10% of 20 things, and I know 10%. So I try to really stay in my own lane as it relates to either the golf swing or the interaction with the human based on, you know, their understanding of themselves. Which I don't, you know, I don't claim to fully know, but I can help them there for sure.
Awesome. All right, man. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know, like, you're nearly on a whirlwind press tour with this pro sender. So I just wanted to finish with a quote from you. And we know what quotes, they can be like a little bit attributed, but I think this is one from, and it fits in nicely because I remember you recommending some books like Man's Search for Meaning, which was so good for me to learn so much from that. And I think this is about your dad. And you said, and a Scottish guy, which side of Glasgow is he from? The blue or the green side?
He's green.
Oh, there we go. Good man. Right. We're good. So this is the quote, and you can tell me if this is accurate or not. And you're like, my dad always told me to live every day as though I knew I was going to die at the end of the day tomorrow. Not die painfully, but just cease to exist. What would I do in that time I had left? Would I worry about some writer throwing me under the bus? Would I worry about the accountant who burned me for a grand? No, I'd spend that day around my parents, wife, and little boy. I'd maybe have some beers. I'd dwell on the things that have given me happiness. Still accurate?
Yeah, no, I think so. Yeah, very much. My dad will tell you that he didn't say that to me, though. He said that I've always quoted him with so many things that I came up with. I don't know. But yeah, like I said, man, earlier, it's a dash, right? It's a dash. Like, what are you gonna work so worked up about? Like, I watched down here with politics and stuff. And when I was back home in Canada, it felt more American to me than I remember. And you know, populist ideas. And like, what am I gonna get wrapped up in all that for? Like, what am I gonna do? Like, unless I intend to get elected and do something about it, then what am I going to do about it? What, just sound smarter than you? Like, what's the, like, why do I need to intellectually bully people? So to me, you know, that is very true. I'm not going to get to, I'm going to leave my thumbprint. And, you know, if, however that scene is how it's seen, but I'm not spending one day worried about the perception of what I do and how I do it. That the thing is, no one will ever know you and what you've done enough to even understand it. So if they're saying good things or bad things about you, they're still assuming.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's awesome. So from a personal standpoint, to thank you for everything you've helped me with. And again, I know I try to be always respectful to you or Bully or any of the lads in terms of how precious your time is, and especially your family time. So I know you're very generous to me. So again, I can't thank you enough. And I know you do a lot, and I've seen you kind of do a lot of stuff, even COVID, for other coaches to help them out, to help them learn, to help them develop. So just personally from me and from, I presume, those guys as well, I want to thank you very much for that. So
yeah, good. Each one teach one, right?
That's the thing, man. All right, Sean, thank you so much. Continued success with the pro sender. I'm sure it's going to sell out even quicker probably the next time. And again, thanks for taking the time this evening, man. Really, really appreciate it.
Okay, Steve. Thanks, mate.
Cheers, man.
Bye.
All right, so that wraps up another episode. Massive thank you to Sean Foley for coming on the show. As I mentioned in the intro, I hope you all got something from this podcast, and I'd highly encourage you to even listen to other pods with Sean as a guest, as you can learn even more about what he does so well. A good friend of mine, Jason Sutton, aka The Golf Guru, has a great episode with Sean if you look back through his library on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you want to know more or follow Sean on socials, he is on Instagram at Sean Foley Performance. And to check out the Pro Sender device, you can go to prosendergolf.com, which is prosendorgolf.com,
or Insta at ProSenderGolf, spelt the same way. Big thank you to you, the listeners out there, as again, without you listening and downloading these podcasts, there probably wouldn't be a show. I really appreciate the support and the feedback. And just a reminder, if you do enjoy it, please make sure to rate the show on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. As always, if you want to work with myself in person or online through the Skillist platform, or indeed have any questions on golf or the podcast, you can contact me on Instagram at SteveMoreGolf or through my website, SteveMoreGolf.com. Finally, for your own game, don't forget, work hard, work diligently, but most importantly, work smart. And we'll talk to you again soon.